This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Jeremy Scahill's book, Blackwater, published in 2007, concerned a powerful private military company hired quietly by the United States government to operate in Iraq and Afghanistan and carry out the, quote, global war on terror. Scahill's book won the George Polk Book Award. His new book, Dirty Wars, is about another covert operation, this time carried out by JSOC, elite members of the Joint Special Operations Command and the CIA's Special Activities Division. Scahill writes about members of these forces getting their marching orders from the Obama White House, using kill lists, drone strikes, detention, and night raids to track down, capture, and kill people identified as terrorists. Scahill investigated attacks in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia and found civilian victims and growing resentment against the United States. Jeremy Scahill is national security correspondent for The Nation magazine and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. It's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here.
Your book is about these covert wars being carried out by the United States, essentially by the White House as well. And these organizations, JSOC and the CIA Special Activities Division, how does one get to be a member of one of these forces?
JSOC was formed in 1980, sort of out of the ashes of the failed hostage rescue mission in Iran. And if you go back and look at history, I mean, now we had Argo that came out, this movie about it, but there's actually quite a fascinating history. There was very poor coordination among the various branches of the military that were involved with that operation. And so they decided to sort of form an all-star team that was made up of two units that were called special missions units, meaning that they're deniable military units that can engage in ultra-secret covert operations, SMUs they're called. One of them was SEAL Team 6. And at the time, SEAL Team 6 was formed.
Which we know
because of the Osama bin Laden raid. And SEAL Team 6 was formed at a time when there were only actually two other SEAL teams. And they gave it the number 6 to try to throw the Soviets off, to make them think that we had more of a capacity of these elite forces than we did at the time. One of the original members of SEAL Team 6 was a guy named William McRaven, who now is running all of these global covert wars for Obama as the commander of SOCOM, the Special Operations Command. And we can talk about McRaven later, but he's a fascinating character
later,
who has a degree in journalism, by the way. So McRaven's an original member of SEAL Team 6. So JSOC starts at SEAL Team 6. It's the Army's Delta Force, the 75th Rangers, and then they have helicopter pilots from the 160th. They're called the Night Stalkers. And these were the guys that, in the Osama bin Laden raid, were flying these stealth helicopters that were created and used for that mission. So for much of its history, JSOC was used in a sort of surgical way, and they were talked about in hushed tones in the Pentagon, and they kind of were viewed as the sort of kids that you don't want to talk about at all, like sort of doing some bad stuff down the hall. And they were involved with counterproliferation. When there was a general that had been kidnapped at one point in Italy, and they went in to rescue him. Under Clinton issued an exemption under the Posse Comitatus Act that remains classified, that authorized JSOC to operate on U.S. soil. So, for instance, there were JSOC personnel involved with the raid in Waco, Texas, in 1993, and then Black Hawk Down, happens, and Clinton basically chains them to a fence and says, when we let these guys run loose, things get out of control. And they were largely chained to that fence until 9/11.
Well, and would you say that this is then a sort of almost like a paramilitary group run out of a White House, whether it's Obama White House or Clinton White House or Reagan or Bush?
The force was designed and remains the sort of president's private army. It's not that the president isn't the commander-in-chief under Article 2 of the Constitution. He certainly is, and he's in control of all armed forces. But JSOC, what separates JSOC from the Marines, for instance, is that you have a much more streamlined communication directly from the White House to the commanders of these individual units. And, I'm told by sources from within government that Obama is very taken with JSOC, that very early on in his administration, Admiral William McRaven won him over. One of the defining moments that set Obama and JSOC on a course to be sort of close allies had very little to do with the global war on terror, if anything. A U.S.-flagged vessel called the Maersk Alabama was hijacked off the coast of Somalia. And people, I'm sure remember that, and it's being made into a movie starring Tom Hanks as Captain Richard Phillips.
Green Glass is the director.
Right. So there's a whole backstory to that that's fascinating, which is that That the Maersk is a U.S. defense contractor. And this was the first U.S. flagged vessel that I think had been hijacked in 100 years. So Obama's presented with this crisis where this American is being whizzed back to the Somali mainland, this American captain. A ship has been taken by these Somali pirates. And so he deploys members of SEAL Team 6, which now is actually known as the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, or DEVGRU. They don't call it SEAL Team 6 anymore. And they were based at this clandestine base that the U.S. uses in Lamu, Kenya, called Camp Simba. So these guys go out and they three Somali pirates dead. They capture a fourth one and take him back to the United States to put him on trial. Obama then has McRaven and the other SEALs into the White House. And McRaven pitches Obama on the idea that JSOC should become the policy. Not just the guys to implement the policy, but that there should be a JSOCization of the war on terror, meaning that the hunter-killer teams are going to become the not just the tip of the spear, but the entire spear.
But you also say that funding for this is part of the black budget.
So Parts of it are, yeah.
So it's hard to trace the money that supports this policy or this program.
Well, you know, there's a common misconception that, you know, the CIA does covert operations and the military does overt operations. You know, JSOC does covert operations that even under, you know, there's Title 10 and Title 50 of the U.S. Code govern the oversight function of Congress when it comes to military or intelligence matters. The raid on Osama bin Laden, it was a covert operation, and it was technically a CIA operation. But the CIA didn't carry out the operation. JSOC carried out the operation. Mm-hmm. McRaven was the commander of it. And they do that so that it can be deniable if something goes wrong or if the U.S. just wants to hide its fingerprints. So to have a military force that can go into a country like Pakistan under a covert mandate without telling the local home government, registering the guys, you know, with their intelligence services as spies, for many nations, I think feels like an outrageous violation of their sovereignty. And that's sort of the part of this that separates them from the CIA. Everyone knows the spy game happens, but this is military.
But I wonder, as you said, from your sources, Obama has been taken with this, yeah, with this program. Do you think it's also because the American people are war weary? We don't want to send in, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops into a country, and that this seems like a cleaner, even more professional way of dealing with people who have been defined as enemies of the country.
I mean, no doubt that is the mindset of the Obama administration, and I think it's been very effective in getting a lot of support from liberals. You know, I mean, I think if McCain had won the election and was doing these very same things, I think you would see a lot of pushback against it. But I think that the way that Obama and his counterterrorism team view this is, we want to get out of big scale troop deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we are being shown briefings every day about plots to bring down U.S. airliners. So how do we take the fight to the terrorists? That's the phrase that they use. So you use drones that could be piloted from a trailer in the southwest of the United States. You use clandestine and covert forces that can go in and out of a country, generally without making a peep. You know, we hear about it when things go wrong.
Right.
But they, you know,
or right in the
case of bin Laden, they'll leak every detail about it. And many of the details that they leaked turned out to be completely false about Osama using one of his wives as a human shield and all these things. And that's sort of a whole other issue. But my point is that we know, you know, all these details about the Osama bin Laden raid. That year, there were thousands of night raids. That wasn't even the most dangerous raid that those guys had done that week. And so part of, you know, why I call the book Dirty Wars is not to be a master of the obvious, but because these actually aren't clean wars. I mean, especially when you start getting into targeting people whose identities you don't know, you have to ask the question, are we killing more terrorists than we are making new enemies? And that's a pretty sobering reality to face as an American going to these countries, to hear people saying you're the terrorists.
Well, in fact, and there's a documentary, Dirty Wars, as well. We see you going to Gardez, a part of Afghanistan, where there was a night raid. There was a wedding party, actually, and Americans, part of these elite forces, came in and actually killed several people, including three women.
Two
of whom were pregnant, part of this wedding party. And we see you there talking to family members, and one of them says they think of the Americans as the Taliban.
Yeah, he said we call these guys the American Taliban, and I mean, you know, when
they're bearded, for one thing.
Right, a lot of the guys in the special ops world are, you know, bearded, and I mean, I also you're obviously, listeners can't see me, but I also am a man with a beard, and I'm a white guy, and I look like I could be one of those guys, and oftentimes people think I'm in the CIA. Yeah. I told one Somali warlord once, when he was accusing me of being CIA, I was like, listen, man, use Google and you'll see that I am the least CIA white man that you've probably ever met in your time as a Somali warlord. But you asked about a serious thing, this night raid. So, you know, when I went to Afghanistan with my colleague Rick Rowley, who directed this film that we made, we were looking at doing a story about the war within the war, the sort of covert war buried within the conventional war, the war of night raids and high value targeting. And we go to Gardez, and the short story for your listeners to understand, we discovered that the American commandos that stormed this house that night and killed these three women, two of whom were pregnant, and then these two Afghan guys, one of whom was a senior police commander who was working with the Americans, right, a local commander, they had been fed bad intel by someone who had a grudge to settle with the family. I don't know if it's that they stole their goats 10 years ago or that they had been in a skirmish or there's some kind of domestic power struggle within their province. But the point is that when the American soldiers went in there, they thought what they were doing was raiding a Taliban stronghold. Well, it turns out that it was a naming ceremony for a child that had just been born. They were doing the most un-Taliban-like things that night. They were dancing. There were women without head cover on. So the Americans raid the place thinking it's dangerous. They end up shooting these people. That happens all the time. I've heard so many stories. Oops, we got the bad intel, we go in. None of those soldiers are likely to face a court-martial or any charges. What happened, though, is that they covered it up. They dig the bullets out of the women's bodies and try to remove any evidence that it was an American raid, and then they tell their superior officers that they had stumbled across an honor killing, implying that the family members had killed their own women in the house.
But we also see, and this is part of the documentary, we see McRaven coming, what looks like, back to this village. A goat is sacrificed, and he apologizes for what had happened.
Which is how before that happened, this is, just to give a timeline here, this was in February of 2010 when this raid happened. Prior to that, there had been almost no mention ever of William McRaven in the media. No one would even mention JSOC. It was meant to be a deniable force, and the JSOC commander's identity was classified. So McRaven, his men are the ones that did this thing. They covered it up. It gets exposed that they've covered it up, and they have to cop to it. So McRaven himself shows up in this remote village with two sheep and offers to sacrifice them. And what he was doing was an ancient ritual in Afghanistan of seeking out for forgiveness. The family told me that they believe they had been under the understanding that the person that was coming to visit them was Stanley McChrystal, who General McChrystal at the time was the head of all U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, and that they had conceived a plot to murder Stanley McChrystal. They wanted to stab him to death, and that their local imam told them not to. So instead they get McRaven. They have no idea who he is. They go through this dog and pony show about the apologies, and they're sort of forced into a position of accepting it. But a colleague of mine, Jeremy Kelly, who's a war photographer, had taken a bunch of pictures of McRaven. None of us knew who he was. We could see it on his lapel that it was McRaven, and that he had a Navy BDUs, battle dress uniform on. So then I started to research, well, who's Admiral McRaven? And next thing I know, I'm going to Yemen and Somalia and tracking this unit in the middle of this project. Then writing the book and doing the film, Bin Laden gets killed by these same guys who I've been following around the world. It was surreal. It was a surreal moment for me. And my jaw was on the floor watching Obama make that announcement that night.
Well, I want to pick up on a bunch of things that you just said there. Jeremy Scahill, our guest today on Radio Times. He has a new book. It's called Dirty Wars, and it's subtitled The World is a Battlefield. And he's a national security correspondent for The Nation magazine. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Violinist Gil Shaham joins Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra in concert for the demanding Brahms Violin Concerto. Gil Shaham tickets are available online or by phone 215-893-1999 today. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Gil Shaham plays Brahms with Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
You decide the winners at WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs, June 20th at WHYY in Philadelphia. Food fanatics will love this two-hour tasting, featuring an array of mouth-watering munchies served up by local restaurants and businesses, all competing to be named 2013's Best of the Chefs, with summer beer garden, specialty cocktails, and live music. WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs. Tickets at whyy.org/events.
Hollywood star Angelina Jolie let the world know she chose to have a double mastectomy to reduce her chances of getting breast cancer. We'll speak with a mother and daughter who faced the same dilemma.
I can wait and get cancer and then do it, or I can proactively make the decision to have my breasts removed and prevent it.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Jeremy Scahill, and according to his reporting, the White House is directing secret commandos to carry out a covert war against terror suspects using kill lists and missile and drone strikes and night raids. And Scahill says these tactics are being used in places like Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia, turning civilians against the United States. His book is titled Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Just a couple of more questions, and I do want to move on to Yemen. But one thing that really struck me, and perhaps I just have been living in this studio too long, is you go to a remote part in Afghanistan, and people have cell phones. I mean, people were showing you pictures of this party going on with on their cell phone. Should I be surprised about that?
No, I mean, I understand why you are. I mean, let's remember, too, that there was a poll conducted a couple of years ago that I think it said 92% of Pashtun males, ethnic Pashtun males, had never heard of 9/11. And I mean, it's fascinating. Why do they understand that we're there, you know, in terms of the mentality? Right. But, you know, the technological revolution has hit, you know, totally remote corners of the world. I saw the same thing in Yemen, where this tiny Bedouin village, we have photos of this missile attack that took place because people had cell phones. So, yes. You know, in the course of reporting, you know, it's made our jobs. It's interesting. You can go to a place and people actually have filmed stuff and they carry it around with them on their devices. So, you know, in the case of Afghanistan, we used a Bluetooth device to copy all of these videos and photos that paint an alternative picture to what the Americans say happened on a particular night. In the case of that night raid, you know, they actually had video of the American soldiers walking over the dead bodies.
And you could see their
in
hands,
the room. Their
right?
hands were they were sort of moving things around, and you can hear the audio in the background. In fact, we had an audio engineer clean it up so that we could try to hear if there were names that were said, but we couldn't decipher any. Mm-hmm. But they're, you know, they're basically putting together their version of what happened there that night. And this was just shot by someone who was standing in the room when the Americans happened to be there. And I found this in a number of places: Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan, elsewhere around the world. People are using their cell phone videos. I mean, Twitter, all this stuff has changed the game. There's anyone can sort of be something like a journalist if they put their mind to it,
which helps a journalist working in a remote part of a country.
I think so. Absolutely.
One other thing, just about Afghanistan, and perhaps it was way. The documentary was shot, it seemed so sort of black, gray, and white. Is that what Afghanistan looks like?
I mean, Afghanistan is a staggeringly beautiful country. It is not a particularly colorful countryside. You know, there's these big, gray, imposing mountains and these windy roads, you know, that, like, you know, Pashtun snipers used to go after the British when they tried to take Afghanistan. And, you know, it's you can see how it's an impossible country to conquer. Because of the ethnic diversity, but also because of the terrain. But it's gorgeous in its barren landscape. You know, I mean, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, of course. But I mean, I mean, Yemen also is a stunningly, astonishingly beautiful place. But Afghanistan had a different sort of beauty. There are other parts of Afghanistan that are green and lush and all of that. But the areas where we were traveling during the course of this film were very gray and mountainous.
You also went to Yemen and investigated another, in this case, a drone strike.
It was a cruise missile attack, which is an important detail of the story. I mean, it's an interesting story why it was a cruise missile instead of a drone. But
go ahead.
You know, so President Obama in December of 2009 is briefed by McRaven, Admiral McRaven, who we've been talking about, and people from the CIA, and they say that they have found a high value target in Yemen. They've located him. And that he's a leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and that there are direct threats being plotted against the United States, and that he's in this place called Al-Majla, which is in Abyan province in southern Yemen. And the president ends up authorizing an attack against what they believe is an al-Qaeda training camp. So what happens is that they want to use a drone, but the drones are all being used in Pakistan at the time, because remember, Obama really ratcheted up the drone use, and Pakistan was becoming a drone war. So they had to use cruise missiles instead. And cruise missiles are far less precise than drones, and they carry a much heavier payload on them. So they launch cruise missiles at what they think is an al-Qaeda site, and they use these heinous, and there's no other way to describe them, anti-personnel weapons called cluster bombs. Cluster bombs are banned, actually, under international conventions. They're like flying landmines. I've seen the other side of their use. I mean, they shred people into human beings into meat. So they launch this this attack. But what happens is that the Yemeni government puts out a press release saying that Yemen's Air Force has conducted a strike and killed 34 members of Al-Qaeda in this training camp. The Obama administration then congratulates Yemen on it. This journalist named Abdullah Haider Shaya, this Yemeni journalist, goes to the scene and takes pictures of it and starts broadcasting them around the world, sends them to human rights groups like Amnesty International. They do an analysis on it, and lo and behold, they are American weapons that are not in the possession of other nations.
See the labels, right?
Yeah, and then I saw them with my own eyes, too. I mean, when we went there, then we had the missile parts are still out there. You can see the General Dynamics made in the United States, the cruise missile parts. There were unexploded cluster bombs. Well, it turns out that they only could identify, in the end, one person who had any remote link to Al-Qaeda. He was an old-school Mujahideen who had actually fought in Afghanistan on the U.S. side. The actual body count of it, 14 women were killed, 21 children were killed in this attack. And it seems abundantly clear to me now, after years of investigating this story, there was not an Al-Qaeda training camp there. I think that the Yemeni government fed bad intel to the Americans because they were being pressured to come up with results.
Well, you also write about the fact that this Yemeni journalist was imprisoned and is still in prison, even after, sounds like, some appeals to President Obama.
Yeah, I mean, this is an involved story, but I'll tell the short-ish version of it. So this journalist is speaking about this. He's also interviewing leaders of Al-Qaeda, interviewing Anwar al-Awlaki, this American citizen who was an imam that was on the kill list, the first American that we know of that was targeted for assassination by the United States under the war on terror. So he's doing all this stuff that's really irritating the United States. And one night he gets abducted by the counterterrorism unit in Yemen. There's a Yemeni unit trained by the United States, and they take him to this political security prison, and they stuff him in a cell for 30 days. He just disappears. And then they haul him into a court that was set up by the dictator of Yemen to prosecute journalists for crimes against the state. And they give him a sham trial, and it's condemned by every major human rights organization around the world and within Yemen, all media freedom organizations. It was clear that he was being railroaded because he had reported things that were inconvenient to the dictator of his own country and the U.S. government. He's sentenced to 5 years in prison for being an Al-Qaeda facilitator, and there's uproar in Yemen over it. Posters are hung around the capital, massive posters like billboards calling for his release. He was a very popular journalist in Yemen. So the dictator of Yemen, who is a client, you know, of the United States, decides that it's not worth it for him to keep this guy in jail. So he says, I'm going to pardon him. And the news leaks in the state news agency that Ali Abdullah Saleh is going to pardon Abdullah Haider Shaya, and it's good publicity for the president. Well, the White House gets wind of this. And Obama personally calls Ali Abdullah Saleh and says that the United States is concerned about reports that he's going to release Abdullah Haider Shaya. And the pardon is torn up, and he remains in jail. And when I asked the State Department what the current U.S. position was a few months ago, they said it remains unchanged, that he's dangerous and he should remain in prison. And lest your listeners think that I'm engaged in some conspiracy theory here, I'd invite them to go on over to the White House website, because that call that I'm referencing, I learned about it because the White House put it on the website in a readout of the phone call between Obama and the Yemeni dictator.
Your book and what we've been talking about, attacks where civilians have been killed, would it be fair to say that there have been, quote-unquote, successful raids carried out by JSOC
and some
of these elite forces?
Of course, I mean, absolutely no question. I mean, the one story I tell in the book, I mean, I really did try to tell this story in a way where none of us are neutral, but I wanted to try to show the complexity of the landscape that makes up what's called the global war on terror. One story I tell happened in September of 2009. One of the guys who was one of the plotters of the attacks on our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998 killed hundreds of people, most of them Kenyans, but
yes,
also Americans.
Yes.
This guy named Sali Ali Nabhan, vicious terrorist, is located by JSOC in Somalia. And they do a ground invasion. They use helicopters, actually. And they fly into Somalia, and they take out his convoy that he's in. And then they land in the helicopters, and they retrieve his body, and they fly his body out to a ship in the ocean, and they take DNA samples, and then they bury him at sea.
Wow.
Just like they did with bin Laden, 2 years later. But that was a case of taking down someone who there was very clear evidence that he had been involved with blowing up two American embassies, and there was a almost decade-long manhunt for him, and then JSOC tracked him, and they did what's called F-cubed, find, fix, finish. You find the target, you fix their pattern of life, and you finish them off. And many people within the counterterrorism community say that's the way we should be doing this.
Well, is there congressional oversight? As you say, this is essentially run out of the White House, I guess, no matter who the president is. But are there members of Congress or committees in Congress that sign off or at least oversee some of this?
That's a great question, and the answer is a little bit complicated. The Senate Armed Services Committee, which is chaired by Carl Levin, and you know John McCain is the ranking member. They technically have oversight of all of JSOC's operations, and some of it happens in public, but most of it is behind closed doors. It's in-camera sessions. What I've been told by people that have been in those sessions is that oftentimes the senators don't ask questions to which the answer would pose a problem for them. So they don't ask certain questions of McRaven or McChrystal, who used to run JSOC. They'll make sure that they don't delve into something that would put them in a position of knowing too much. So it's not that there's no oversight. It's that the system is sort of rigged so that these guys are given maximum latitude while the public veneer of oversight can be defended by the White House.
Plausible deniability?
Well, that's a big part of it. I mean, you look at some of the scandals happening right now. I mean, you know, and the poor Jay Carney, you know, the White House press secretary, looks like a sort of lower version of Baghdad Bob on some of these press conferences because he's saying things that, the president learned about this from the press, and they could sound like the president's aloof and out to lunch. Hello, folks, this is what plausible deniability is. They don't want to know. I mean, I had a JSOC guy say to me, they don't want to go into the dark and see what happens behind the curtain. And to an extent, I think that's true, and it's how America has conducted a lot of its covert policies over the decades.
And that's Jeremy Scahill, our guest today on Radio Times. He's national security correspondent for The Nation magazine. A couple of years ago, wrote a book called Blackwater, and his new book is called Dirty Wars, and it's subtitled The World is a Battlefield. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Covered a lot of territory, literally, in this first portion of Radio Times. Let me see what Milton from Wayne has to say. Milton, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'd like to make three comments, and I'll get off the air. The first of all is I strongly support an increased role for JSOC and a reorganization of our forces, including Marine Expeditionary Forces, so that JSOC is our primary weapon against terrorism. The United States has shown that it does not occupy countries well. That is the one thing we do not do. And I personally view JSOC as sort of a miniature version in its strikes of the Powell Doctrine, actually. And my last comment is Somalia is no longer a nation state. And I'll take my responses up here.
Thanks for the call, Milton, the Radio Times. I want to save Somalia because there's a whole chapter on this. But he wants more authority to JSOC.
Yeah, I mean,
we don't occupy countries particularly well.
Right. I mean, in fact, in the book, I mean, that's exactly what one advisor to U.S. Central Command said to me. He said, we're very good at overthrowing governments, but we're not good at building up or at nation building or occupation. And I think this is the trend. When you talk to people in the intelligence community, in the military community, no one really wants to be risking large scale American lives in these wars. But there is a desire to fight these wars and to take out the leadership of these various organizations. And so, how do you do that? Well, JSOC is a very attractive force. I mean, I think it's probably the most elite force of fighters in the world. There's one of the things I found laughable about Zero Dark 30, the portrayal of the JSOC guys where they're throwing horseshoes and joking around and stuff. There are guys who have master's degrees in philosophy that are Navy SEALs or neuroscientists, guys that had a different career and then went back and joined up with Navy SEALs. McRaven himself, has a degree in journalism, is a very, very sharp thinker. They're portrayed as sort of yahoos. I mean, these are fascinating guys. I mean, I have a lot of problem with the secrecy surrounding these operations and the carte blanche that they've been given, because ultimately I think it undermines the democratic system in the United States to allow forces like this to have as much control as they do. But I understand what the caller is saying, and I think that represents a consensus view within the military, certainly at this point.
Milton, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Would it be fair to say that when the Marines, the soldiers leave Afghanistan, that the JSOC will remain?
Oh, yeah, there's no question. In fact, in Iraq, you're going to see an increased role being played, not just by JSOC, but also by the CIA's paramilitary division, the Special Activities Division. You're going to see, I think, a decrease in conventional war in those countries, and then you're going to see a continuation of the high-value targeting, as they call it. And, you know, in Afghanistan, killed our way so far down the list. I mean, Mullah Omar has not been killed or captured that we know of, but killed our way so far down the list that we're actually fighting people now who are only attacking us because we're in their valley. And that's, you know, when you've sort of killed your way so far down that the only motivation people have to fight you is that you're there, it's probably time to rethink your strategy.
Your book, and we have learned more about this kill list, and this is a list of people. I can't even say the word suspects because there's much we don't know about them, but nonetheless, this is a list of people that right. President Obama signs off on.
Well, they're meeting today. It's Tuesday. It's Terror Tuesday at the White House.
Is that what they call it?
Yes. They have a working group. The president himself doesn't generally sit in on the Tuesday meetings. It's a working group of people that are from CIA or the military or within JSOC. And they're going over rosters of people and who, you know, what, going through the intel. Do we know where so-and-so is? Who's been on the phone recently? Who's on the kill list? Who do we think we might be able to capture or get someone to hand over to us? They also have people that have been deemed irreconcilables, where there just simply is a kill order against them. And then those meetings are then funneled to the president and his inner circle. I'm told that the president is very much a micromanager, and they have a baseball card system where the stats are there, and they have photos, if they have them, of the person, and they decide who remains and who gets pulled off of it. And they've created this this program that is meant to endure beyond this administration, called the Disposition Matrix, which was sort of the brainchild of John Brennan, who's now the CIA director. And it's almost like an algorithm to determine who gets killed, who gets captured, who could be extradited. And you know, the most disturbing aspect of the kill program to me is not the assassination of known individuals. I have all sorts of problems with, particularly when it's an American citizen.
Who I want to talk about. Right. Yes, go ahead.
When you're targeting them when they haven't even been charged with a crime and they're not on an active battlefield fighting against U.S. soldiers or attacking U.S. embassies, to kill them without any semblance of due process is something that I think all of us should raise serious questions about. But there's something else that we do in both Pakistan and Yemen called signature strikes. So the ones that I referred to before, where it's an individual personality strikes, then you have signature strikes. Signature strikes are like sort of like pre-crime, like that Tom Cruise movie, a Minority Report, where the ball goes down the thing and pops up. Except we don't know the identities in many cases of the people we're targeting. We have classified certain regions as terrorist regions of Pakistan and Yemen, and anyone who's a military-aged male in that region, gathering with three or five or more other males, and anyone has any remote connection to someone we believe is a terrorist. They went to the mosque with someone. They went into a building known to be used by a terrorist group. They were on the phone with someone. We preemptively say those guys are terrorists, and we can kill them.
And they're men, right? I mean, these are...
Well, women do get killed, but it's
in terms of these signature strikes.
Right. Generally, it's military-aged males. I mean, there certainly are women that who have ended up on the kill list. But in the signature strikes, my understanding, the standard is that it's military-aged males. I think Obama really... is reluctant to want to target women. I mean, he's already got such a problem dealing with the PR on the other end of the drone strikes. I mean, the man won't talk about. I mean, maybe he will on Thursday when he gives his big speech. But the point I'm getting at here is that when you're killing people whose identities you don't know, against whom you don't necessarily have evidence that they're involved with real plots, and then you decide that you can just preemptively kill them, to me that raises the question of: are we creating more new enemies with a legitimate reason to want to hurt us than we are taking out actual terrorists? I've heard from people within the CIA who have told me they're vehemently opposed to the signature strike policy because it's undermining their work in trying to reduce terrorism in these countries.
Let's take another break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I do want to talk about Anwar al-Awlaki. And again, Jeremy Scahill, our guest today on Radio Times, national security correspondent for The Nation magazine. I guess you can still say magazine these days. And author of this new book we've been talking about called Dirty Wars, and it's subtitled The War is a Battlefield. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
St. Joseph's University's Halb School of Business, a supporter of WHYY, offers a Master of Science in International Marketing. This program is designed to prepare students for the global marketplace by taking them across borders and cultures to learn about the world's most dynamic business practices. With an international student body and experienced faculty, the program offers an opportunity to explore new cultures during an international study tour. Study part-time or complete the program in 1 year full-time. More at sju.edu/grad/halb.
To dream the impossible dream.
That's Michael Douglas as Liberace in the new HBO movie Behind the Candelabra. Matt Damon plays his young boyfriend. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Steven Soderbergh about directing the movie. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is my quest to follow that star.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What if you were hired based on a computer algorithm and not after interviews with employers? It's already happening for some tech jobs. Also, how a Danish power grid experiment may change the way all of us use electricity. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. President Obama has been criticized by civil libertarians, some members of his party, about the secrecy and legality of White House kill lists, its covert drone and missile strike program, and the use of special forces to carry out night raids. And one of those critics is our guest today on Radio Times, Jeremy Scahill, author of this new book called Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. This documentary, the book, is about the assassination, or I should say the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen. He was living in Yemen at the time and had been, in a sense, put on this, I guess, this kill list that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, al-Awlaki is a fascinating guy, and it's sort of, it's the spine of the book, you know, the telling of his story, because I find it, you know, it's not just about who he was, it's about who we are as a country. You know, I mean, I believe that the way a society is judged is how we treat the least of our people, you know, not the most popular or the most powerful, but how do we treat those who are either disenfranchised or are reprehensible? You know, that's the real challenge of who we are as people. But Awlaki's story is fascinating. You know, he's this guy who's born in New Mexico. His dad was a Fulbright scholar, and his dad is an upstanding, wonderful man who I've gotten to know very well. He didn't raise his son to be a jihadist or a terrorist.
In fact, he calls him an all-American boy.
Right. And and you know, he's a guy who's a very well-respected academic in Yemen with close ties to, you know, American officials throughout his career, working with USAID, building up a university in Yemen, trying to, you know, deal with the country's water crisis. Anyway, he had come to the United States as a student, wanted to raise his son in the image of what he perceived to be the sort of American idealism and progressivism in the world. And you know, the book is hundreds of pages long about this, but the short of it is this: al-Awlaki ends up, he wasn't a particularly religious guy, but he ends up getting politicized during the Gulf War in 91 and decides that he wants to become an imam. And so he becomes an imam first in San Diego and then in Virginia. 9/11 happens, and Anwar al-Awlaki becomes a media celebrity. What? He's on Talk of the Nation on NPR. He's on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Washington Post profiles him. And the reason, and I remember I was working as a young radio producer trying to book him, because he was explaining the very complicated reality facing Muslims in the United States after the 9/11 attacks. You know, this community, like everyone else, horrified by what had happened, condemning it. Overwhelmingly, Muslims condemned that attack. And al-Awlaki was representing that voice, but also speaking out against the attacks that were happening against Muslim businesses and individuals. So he was invited to the Pentagon, and he gave a lecture at the Pentagon on the state of Islam in the world today.
Sort of explaining this to... Yeah.
We got the documents from that meeting at the Pentagon, and they actually served a bacon sandwich at it, which just gives you a sense of the intelligence, the quality of the intelligence at the time. You invite an imam and serve bacon. So what ends up happening is that al-Awlaki becomes radicalized by the wars, by Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and Iraq and threats towards Syria, and becomes a sort of internet imam, and he is preaching these sermons, and his tapes and CDs start to pop up in terror investigations around the world. Mm. And eventually the U.S. and Yemeni governments have him thrown in prison in Yemen for 18 months, 17 in solitary confinement. He comes out a totally changed man, praises the Fort Hood shooting, the massacre that Nidal Hassan carried out. It turns out that al-Awlaki had been in email touch with him, though there's never been evidence that al-Awlaki had anything to do with the plot, but he called Nidal Hassan, who massacred 13 soldiers in Fort Hood, Texas, a hero.
Well, in fact, and I'm just looking at a New York Times piece about it, Nidal Hassan is a hero. He's a man of conscience. Yep. Who could not bear living the contradiction of being a Muslim and serving in an army that is fighting against his own people.
Absolutely. And, you know, so al-Awlaki not only called him a hero, but said other Muslims in the U.S. military should do the same thing as Nidal Hassan. Then the underwear bomber, bombing happens, or doesn't happen, you know, thank God. This deranged young Nigerian guy tries to blow up, at a U.S. send his underpants on fire and over Detroit. And once again, Awlaki praises that attack. And it turns out that Awlaki had met with Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab in Yemen. So, you know, Awlaki is sort of becoming, you know, getting himself into the crosshairs. The first time the U.S. tries to kill him is December of 2009. Then over the next 2 years, by my calculation, over a dozen attempts to kill Awlaki. And President Obama was intent on getting him. And there are the only funny moments in my book. There's a story about how the CIA actually helps facilitate a second, or actually I think it was a third wife for Anwar Awlaki while he was underground. They work with an ex-jihadist who knew Awlaki, and they convince Awlaki to take this wife. She doesn't know that she's involved with the plot. This young woman from Croatia. It's sort of like, you know, jihadist OK Cupid or something. You know, they're like having their back and forth, sending videos. She goes to Yemen, you know, not knowing that the CIA is paying for everything, with luggage provided to her by the CIA with tracking devices in it. She gets to Yemen. They ditch the bags. She marries Anwar Awlaki, and they have a kid underground. So I call that chapter the CIA's dating service. So they facilitate this thing. So they try to pay Awlaki's brother $5 million to give up his location. They find this bride for Awlaki. They're failing. Then they find him, and September 30th, 2011, drone strike kills Anwar Awlaki and another American citizen, Samir Khan, who was the editor-in-chief of Inspire magazine, the glossy magazine of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about that, because I think it touches on some very raw nerves. And I was trying to imagine if in World War II, and this is not a perfect analogy, an American went over and in a sense, supported the Nazis.
It did happen.
Well, I'm sure it did happen. And the idea that we would want to target that person if they were inspiring people to fight against American soldiers or Marines. Is there a case to be made that Anwar Awlaki was a danger to America?
Sure. And I think, I mean, look, I in this discussion, you know, remember what I said at the beginning, right, about how I don't think it's so much about who he is, about who we are. I'm willing to say, just for argument's sake, that every single thing that's ever been leaked about Anwar Awlaki is true. I don't believe that, but I'm willing to just for the sake of argument, say, okay, let's say that he was involved with the Fort Hood shooting. He was involved with the underwear plot, directing it. You know, was plotting to poison American water supplies or bring down U.S. aircraft. Okay, if that's the case, we have a legal system that is so robust to deal with those kinds of crimes or criminal plots. We can indict him. We can demand his extradition. None of that happened. So what happened is that they fast forward past the phase of giving him any day in court. It's not just that they didn't give him a day in court. They never even presented evidence against him. And then they fast forward to the death penalty for this guy. If President Obama, who is a constitutional lawyer by trade and won the Nobel Peace Prize, if he had said, let's get an indictment against Awlaki and we're going to set a time period. This guy has 90 days to surrender. And if he doesn't surrender, we're going to engage in a different way of bringing him into justice. I still would have been opposed to it, me personally, on a moral level. I have a real problem with doing this, but I would have understood. At least they made the effort to indict him. This is an American citizen; he has rights.
But what you know about JSOC? Could JSOC have gone into Yemen and captured him and brought him back to the United States?
Not only could that have happened, I actually think that the U.S. could have gotten the tribes that were protecting him to hand him over. I think the U.S. One of the big scandals in Yemen that never gets talked about that I think is a scandal. The U.S. doesn't have any old fashioned spying going on. We've outsourced the whole thing to technology. We're killing people whose identities we don't know. I believe that they could have apprehended Anwar Awlaki, just as I believe they could have apprehended any number of people that have been killed in these drone strikes. Part of it is, where are you going to put them? Obama doesn't want to stick them in Guantanamo. They don't really want to give Anwar Awlaki his day in court, because what's going to happen? He's going to become a martyr. He's going to put the U.S. government on trial. He's going to get – I probably know the lawyers who would end up representing him, and they're fantastic lawyers, and they would take that case, and they would fight it because it would be a groundbreaking case. They don't want that. So the kill capture becomes pretty much kill. You know, under President Obama, every time they try to prosecute someone in the civilian courts here, the Republicans go bananas over it. They want this Tsarnaev kid in Boston to be sent to Guantanamo. You know, he's another American citizen, you know.
But even though we know that essentially that the court system has worked in the past,
it's the only thing that's worked to hold these terrorists to account. Whenever the Obama administration has actually like done the right thing in this case, the Republicans go bananas over it. But it's a victory for rule of law. because it's these people do not represent an existential threat to the United States. We have a bigger threat facing us in our own gun culture in this country, you know, and these school shootings. They represent a far greater threat to our security than some wacko extremists in the mountains of Yemen. I don't want them to bring down U.S. aircraft. I think we're more likely to see that happen because of our actions, and that's part of why I wrote the book. I don't want that reality for our, facing our country.
Let me get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jared from Princeton calling us on Radio Times. Jared, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if you could describe the chain of informational transactions by which a targeted person comes to the notice of U.S. forces, and then from the U.S. point of view, what steps do the CIA, JSOC, et cetera, take typically to test and verify the info before they target someone for assassination?
Jared,
yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, I tell the story of one guy who was a that I've interviewed and talked to, who was working for the Defense Intelligence Agency on Yemen at the time when they were hunting Anwar al-Awlaki. And he told me, and this story is in the book, he told me that he was stunned when he learned that you only needed three human intelligence reports, meaning like three reports that someone is involved with terrorist activity to qualify them to be on the kill list. And, you know, we don't know exactly what those bits of information could be. It could be that they purchased a series of disposable cell phones for someone that the U.S. was monitoring, and he was a courier of sorts. Or it could be someone that they've picked up chatter on, that he's involved with a plot to use, you know, sarin gas or something. You know, it's basically kind of mystery. It could be any number of things that could put someone on the kill list, but that you have three independent human intelligence reports that indicate that this person is a terrorist, then they can end up on the list. And there are three kill lists that I'm aware of. One is operated by the CIA. One is operated by JSOC. And then the other is a joint list that is overseen at the National Security Council level. People think of the National Security Council as this big thing. It's a big body. It's not. It's the president, vice president, defense secretary, national security advisor, and the secretary of state. And then they have advisors. So you have these three groups. And there are interagency working groups that go through, vet the intelligence. And then the president, my understanding, is very much involved with deciding who's going to stay on it and who's going to stay off it. JSOC also has what's called the hot pursuit clause, which is that if they're tracking someone and they cross a border from, you know, Ethiopia into Somalia, they can cross the border with them and take them out. And that's happened many times.
Jared, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm going to quote something that Dick Cheney said on September 16th, 2001. He was on Meet the Press being interviewed by Tim Russert at the time. And these are now his famous or infamous words. But this is Vice President Dick Cheney. We also have to work, though, a sort of dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies, if we're going to be successful. Obviously talking about the terror attacks of September 11th. That's the world these folks operate in, Cheney says, and so it's going to be vital for us to use any means at our disposal, basically to achieve our objective. Do you think that's what President Obama believes?
Yeah.
And would those be the, I mean,
I think, though, that he, you know, I think look, under Dick Cheney, these guys set up a series of black sites where they committed heinous acts of torture against people around the world. You know, look at Guantanamo, how many people have been cleared for release and they still languish in that prison, you know, three dozen of whom are now being force-fed. I don't think that Obama agrees with the Cheney vision of what the dark side is. What I think that Obama has done, though, he's trying to create an enduring program that has the cover of legitimacy or legality. That's what they're really trying to do here. So instead of the CIA running the black sites, what Obama is doing is using other nations' human rights abusing forces to hold prisoners, which is something that Clinton did in the 90s too. We would send people to Egypt or Syria or wherever. So Obama's continuing to do that. He's borrowing from the Clinton era approach to this and trying to create a more permanent, streamlined way of operating on the dark side. And I think that's going to be one of the enduring legacies of Obama, is not just that, but that he also sold it to liberals as a more effective way of waging war.
And picking up on that, as you mentioned, you thought if John McCain were president doing this, liberals would be very upset about it.
I think they'd be calling for his impeachment.
Well, yeah. I mean, but I can't get inside President Obama's head, clearly. Yeah. But I'm wondering if there's a way, and as you said, he's a constitutional scholar or professor, a way to understand how he thinks of this and whether he thinks of this the way Dick Cheney was thinking about.
No, I don't. No. I think I think Obama and Cheney are very different people in my mind. I think that President Obama is sincere. I think he believes that what he's doing is, keeping the United States safe. I think he thinks it's the least bad way of doing it. But that doesn't excuse what I think are sort of the incredible leaps we've taken across a line that I think is a dangerous line to have crossed. But I don't, you know, I do think of Cheney as a caricature, sort of sitting in his lair plotting the destruction of the world for Halliburton stock. I mean, I'm sorry if that sounds like a nut, but I really kind of do see him that way. With Obama, I think he, look, this is a guy who had no foreign policy experience really to speak of. Certainly no military experience. He comes into office and he's briefed by these ultra-powerful figures, McRaven, McChrystal, Petraeus, and they say, the world is full of people that want to murder Americans, and if you don't take the fight to them, they will take the fight to us. What's he going to do in that position? So he's chosen to outsource it to JSOC, and that's a large part of the policy. Mm. JSOC and CIA activity has become the policy.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but clearly, as we all know, the kinds of wars we're involved in now are not like World War I or World War II.
It's asymmetric warfare, right? Non-uniform.
Asymmetric, and yeah. One without a peace treaty at the end. I mean, and your book is subtitled "The World Is a Battlefield." Dexter Filkins talks about the forever war.
Yeah.
And it's this. I mean, is this sort of how we're going to operate in the world?
Right. I mean, the last thing I say in the book is how does a war like this ever end? You know, because President Obama, when he was sworn in for his second term, said, you know, the U.S. doesn't want to exist in a perpetual state of war. And that day they bombed Yemen again. And I think it's become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. I wrote this and we made the film because we want to have people asking those questions in their own homes, because it shouldn't just be military families that have to think about what's going on overseas mm-hmm. when the U.S. is engaged militarily. We all have a moral and ethical and patriotic duty, I think, to understand what's being done in our name and with our money around the globe.
Well, Jeremy Scahill, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, Jeremy Scahill, our guest, national security correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of this hefty new book called Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And his previous book, Blackwater, written back in 2007, won the George Polk Book Award. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including checking us out on Facebook and Twitter and email, the archives, and satellite radio as well. Bob Ball is the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Assistance from Emily Bryant. And the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us.